Rennie Harlan is one of the great action movie directors, and we're very lucky to have him as a guest in this episode, not just because of all the films he's done and the massive influence he's had on the genre and on filmmaking in general, but because he has some really great insights. He shares with us some lessons he learned the hard way early on, how he made the jump from literally nothing and living, you know, one paycheck to another, barely able to eat, to becoming a major film director, getting offered and turning down huge projects. So what made him walk away from certain opportunities that I didn't even know he ever had, and how he learned to get better and continues to learn to get better on set. What really captures Rennie Harlan's essence is his passion and love for doing this. He says many times how lucky he feels to be able to direct movies. And it shows in his work. And it shows in this interview. Well, first of all, it's really exciting to have you here. One of the great directors, action directors, your prolific career. We're excited about The Misfits and definitely want to get into talking about that. But I kind of wanted to go back, as we often do on our podcast, and ask you a little bit about where your career began. What happened? What made you start down the path of becoming a director? What was the first thing in your life, I guess, that made you think, this is what I want to do? This is what's going to happen.
That's a big question, but I'll try to I'll try to make my answer concise. But it was really started with my mom, who was a avid moviegoer, and my dad, being a busy doctor, never had time to go to the movies with her. So she started taking me since I was 5 years old, and I saw all, you know, Hitchcock movies and Roman Polanski movies and all kinds of thrillers and action movies and everything since I was really small, and just fell in love with movies and that type of storytelling, and then started making my own little home movies and drawing my comic books and writing my stories, and then at some point I realized that there was such a person as a director behind these movies, and then it just became my obsession that that's what I want to do. I want to tell stories. I think to a certain extent, probably all directors share this, which is that we are kind of like kids who never grow up, and so we're just like making playthings. Like I just finished shooting another movie literally yesterday. We were doing this night shoot and this sort of a big war scene with people with machine guns and helicopters and explosions and stuff like that. And I was just having the best time of my life. I had been up for like 2 days and two nights, and being tired was the last thing on my mind. And I just looked around and I said, who gets to do this stuff? This is just the greatest life. And so I just wanted to make movies, and it's never changed. I get the same thrill from it that I got when I was a kid. And so I grew up in Finland, population 5 million, minuscule movie industry, especially in those days in the 70s. And so making movies in Finland was pretty much impossible. But
I'm just curious, were there Finnish filmmakers or any kind of like any world around it? Or did you know other kids who were doing what you were doing? Like you say you were making your own, like what was the culture for you like at that time? Because there was no internet, obviously, so you couldn't connect to people around the world doing it.
No, couldn't connect with people around the world or couldn't connect with anybody, even in Finland. So there were a handful of Finnish directors who made very small, very Finnish movies, which were financed by the government. So they were like very, very, very serious art, and they had to be about issues in society and just you know, very heavy kind of serious things. And nobody went to see the Finnish movies. I mean, literally, like people watched American movies like crazy, but nobody would go and watch a Finnish movie because it was like, okay, I already have all those problems in my life. I don't want to go to a movie theater to be reminded me of them. So the film industry was minimal, and I didn't know anybody in the film business. And it was just a completely I got a chance to make an industrial video for one. Actually, it was for Shell Oil Company. They needed a video about some of their products, and somehow I got that gig. I did that, and as a result of that, I got a gig to do some commercials, and I started my own company and started making commercials. And I did go to film school also, but soon, you know, again, it was a government-financed film school that had no money to make movies, so all we did was take pictures with still cameras and and sit around and listen to some kind of a cynical
lecture.
To be honest, like a cynical want-to-be filmmaker tell us about filmmaking without having really made any movies, because it was so hard in Finland and there was no money and all that. So it was just kind of a very negative atmosphere, I felt. And I felt like I can learn these things by reading books. I've already read these books, so I don't need to sit here and listen to somebody drone about it. And like I said, there was no money to make movies, actually. So it was just it was a waste of time. So I quit film school, and I just started doing my own things. And I was...
So you were making commercials, though, basically.
You kind of got started
making commercials.
Yeah, I was like 20 years old and making commercials. And then got won some awards for those and got some attention. So then I was hired to do TV. So I did some TV films. I did some documentaries. And to me, really, the best film school was making commercials, because in 30 seconds you had to tell a story about some lady who is using some special dishwashing liquid and it makes her life better. So in 30 seconds, you have to tell that story. You have to get the emotion across. You have to show the product. You have to film it. You have to edit it. You have to put music there. And it's a 30-second movie. So especially in those days, people were like the serious artistic people in the movie business in Finland, if you can call it a movie business. They looked at commercial filmmaking as something really bad and kind of looked down at it like, oh, you're doing commercials, you know, that's like
the world.
I was saying, well, I get to make, you know, 20 movies a year. You haven't made one movie in 20 years. So they might be only 30 seconds long or 45 seconds long, but they are movies and I'm learning all the time. And then I just, you know, I always had the dream of getting into features, and then miraculously with a friend of mine, we were both like 21, 22, something. We wrote a script and we put all our savings together and used our credit cards and whatever we could to make a movie. And completely miraculously, we made a feature in Finland with American actors and made it in English. And it was a little, tiny little genre action movie. But it got released. It got sold all over the world in every movie watching country in the world. And it
was Born American.
And it was released.
Yeah, and that you guys put your own money into it, and it ended up with international distribution.
Absolutely.
Like it was everywhere. That's amazing.
We got released in 1,200 theaters in America, and movie made some money. Of course, we didn't make a cent because we made such stupid deals, you know, getting the financing together. We didn't even have a lawyer. They asked, who's your lawyer? And we thought, are we in trouble? Is there some... We were used to, in Finland, you just like shake hands. You don't make any... sign any papers.
Is everybody too honest there? Is that
they gave us a huge pile of papers to sign, and we just said like that. We didn't even read the contract. We said, "Oh, does the contract say that you know we are putting up half of the money, and you are putting up half of the money, and then we, you know, share the movie 50-50, something like that?" They said, "Yeah, that's exactly what it says." I said, "Great." Of course, it said in, you know, lawyer language, it said that if the movie made $1 billion, we would maybe share, you know, like 1 cent. But anyhow, I didn't even get my directing salary, because I had to give my directing salary as a guarantee to the lab to get the movie out of the materials, because we ran out of money. So we didn't make a cent, but we got to make a movie, which was great. And then,
it put you on the map, right? Like it really did.
It put me on the map as a very, very tiny, tiny little dot on the very big map of the world. But at least I did exist, and it gave me the encouragement to actually to move to Los Angeles and to start seeking my opportunity. And it wasn't easy, and it took a few years, of complete poverty and living in somebody's garage with no money, literally.
And you didn't know anybody, and you just moved to this country, right? So there's a lot of extremes. Yeah,
I knew nobody, and I literally, like, I didn't know where I was getting money to buy food. It was literally that.
How did you survive those years? Like, was it just courage and the?
I survived by writing movie reviews to obscure little newspapers in Finland in some tiny little town of 7,000 people. Huh. I would their newspaper would have a movie review by me, and I would make a few bucks that way. And then literally there was a year, I think it was around 86 or 87. There was a year when my weekly budget was $5 a week. I had to survive on $5 a week to buy the cheapest possible food and the most filling food I could find, and just try to stay alive. And it was really particularly tough because I didn't have enough money to go and see movies. So I couldn't go to a movie theater because I didn't have enough money to pay for the ticket. So that was kind of like it. I could live without food, but it was hard to live without movies. So people often say to me like things like, "Oh, you've been so lucky to get to make movies and this kind of stuff." And I say, you definitely need luck in life. It is a big part of things, but the luck doesn't just land on your lap when you're sitting on the sofa. You have to work very hard for it, and you have to create those opportunities, find your place in the world, be hopefully in the right place at the right time, and make luck happen, because otherwise nothing will happen.
I can only imagine how hard it was, and you persevered, and like things turned around in a big way. But like, what kept you motivated? How long am I going to give this? You know, like how long were you like, I'm going to?
Very good question. And the answer is simple. I was too embarrassed to go back to Finland because, some Finnish people, whether they are musicians or artists or of other kinds or business people, they've tried to leave Finland and go and do something else somewhere else. And there's a saying in Finland, like you come back with the return train. The train will turn and you will be back. So there's a real sort of a sarcasm about Finnish people who try to, go and kick the tires in a bigger world, and the attitude is like, you can talk big, but you'll be back. And so
nice, I love it. I love that you were like, there's no way I'm coming back defeated.
No, literally, especially in the tiny, tiny, tiny little movie world of Finland, where everybody knew each other. The fact that I left for America, everybody was literally laughing at me and shaking their heads. And it sort of a sarcastic pity is what people were feeling for me.
Wow.
And I was so embarrassed about the idea of going back and admitting that they were right and I'm a failure, that I literally said to my mom when I was able to put enough coins together to call her, maybe once in a couple of months, I could call a quick short call to her. I said, "Mom, I'm rather going to die here than come back and admit that I'm a failure for the rest of my life." And my mom was beside herself, and she was she was just miserable. But I said, that's the truth. I cannot come back. So I have to thank all those sarcastic people who were laughing at me. I have to thank them.
They motivated me.
Streamlining the post-production video editing process just got a whole lot easier with Spider Checker Video. It's a handy, portable tool designed to leverage how video is processed when working with vector scopes, waveform monitors, and editing software. Included is a patent-pending color pattern card that generates an easy-to-understand pattern of hues at 2 saturation levels, so you can see how all colors between primary and secondary colors are being captured. The result? You start off with more accurate color at the start of your video shoots, so you have less color editing to do later. Now you can save $20 off the purchase price of Datacolor Spider Checker Video. Just visit datacolor.com/NFS and enter code NFS at checkout. Offer is valid in US and Canada through 6/30/24.
Things turned around like Nightmare on Elm Street 4. Right? And Prison. Those were the next features you did. And then Die Hard 2.
Like, how do you go, like, you go from starving to, like, one of the biggest action movie sequels on the cusp of the explosion of action movies in this, in the genre, really. Like, it was born. Yeah. Like, that's a huge shift that happens for you in, like, 3 years.
Yeah.
Like,
it was, it was pretty insane how things went. And because I did Born American in Finland, then I had really, really, really tough times in Los Angeles. Then I got my next gig, which was a little horror film called Prison. And right. And that kind of went nowhere. Now it's become kind of a cult favorite for a lot of people. But at that point, it sort of went nowhere. But
how did you get that? Have being the heart, like starving and
all I had was Born American, and I would show that to anybody I could find. I literally knew nobody, and it was literally me going to the Yellow Pages and going to P for producers or F for financing, and just cold calling people and going to their offices unannounced. I didn't know how you make an appointment and that you have to talk to some assistant or some receptionist or something. I just went there and I said, "Hi, I'm a film director and here's the videotape of my movie. And could you get the famous producer who works here to watch it?"
Yeah.
And I just kept doing that and it went nowhere until miraculously somehow this producer, Irvin Yablans, happened to see my movie and he had discovered John Carpenter, the director of Halloween. He produced Halloween. Right. So he had that feeling like, you know, sometimes young people who haven't done much could be a surprise, positive surprise. So he gave me Prison to make, and that was my big chance. And we did Prison. It you know, didn't, like I said, it didn't really go much of anywhere. But now I had another thing that I could show people that, what my calling card was, that I can do inventive, visually enticing stuff with very little money.
Yeah.
And that was a good thing. And so then when Nightmare on Elm Street 4 came up and they needed a director, I went after it like crazy. I didn't even have an agent at that point. I couldn't get anybody to take me on as a client. But I just went there, and I went there 6 times just to talk to the head of the company, Bob Shea, who later on became a very close friend of mine. But they just, I was just so crazy in my passion that they couldn't sort of just ignore it. And so I miraculously I got that job. Their only franchise, their big franchise, the whole company depended on Nightmare on Elm Street. And I got that, and miraculously it worked out, and the movie became a big hit, and even for a fourth sequel to get good reviews was unheard of, and it changed my life overnight. It literally, opening weekend of Nightmare on Elm Street 4, on Monday morning, my first phone call was Steven Spielberg called me and said, "I saw your movie, I love it, I want to meet you," and wow. I made a deal to develop a movie with him. And all studios called, and next movie I signed on to do at that point was Alien 3. And
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, I was supposed to do Alien 3, and I worked on the Fox lot for several months on it, and obviously I was following in the footsteps of Ridley Scott and Tim Cameron, and I
yeah some big like guys.
These were some huge shoes to fill, and I wanted to do something spectacular. But then we just had completely different ideas, the studio and I, about the direction of the movie and what the story should be and so on. And then I just had to follow my heart and take one of the biggest risks of my life, which was I quit Alien 3. And it's when you're, you know, in your 20s and you get a giant studio movie, you don't quit it, you know, if you ever want to be heard of again. But I just had to be honest to myself, and I just had to say, it's not going to work out, and I'm going to look stupid. And next to Ridley Scott and Jim Cameron, I'm going to look like an idiot. And I quit without any knowledge of any other job or any hope in my life. But I had to do it. And it turned out to be a smart thing, because literally next day, Fox offered me another movie, which was The Adventures of Fort Fairlane. And I took it. And then in the middle of shooting that, they were so happy with the results and everything that was happening that they offered me Die Hard 2. And then I took that and started that almost immediately after I finished shooting Port Vale. So then things just snowballed from there. But it was really the toughest challenge of my whole life was to get the job to do Nightmare on Elm Street. And then the fact that that was a huge hit changed my life literally.
Yeah, it seems like you really highlighted in retelling it that it was your persistence and passion that you could do it in a visually exciting way, cheap, right? That was what you were saying. Like, I'm passionate about this and I can do it this certain way. And then that's it. I mean, I do like the boldness of, like, very few people ever have that experience where, you know, you're getting calls from Spielberg, everybody wants to work with you, and you get one of the biggest franchises in the world. And it's Aliens, and it's this highly anticipated movie. And it's like, and you had the moment of saying, I don't think this is going to go right for me. I need to make a different choice. Like, that could have been, that could have been suicide in a sense, but it worked out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was it just the creative of it? Was it like, it's not going to work the way I want it to?
Yeah, I presented them two scenarios, what I thought the movie should be. We had now seen Alien and we had seen Aliens, and now this was Alien 3. I said, one scenario that I believe in is that if people now are flying to the planet that the aliens originally are from, it's like if you think of aliens like ants, I want to go to the anthill and find out, what are they really? Why are they the way they are? Why are they doing what they are doing? Why are they so hideous? Or is it just their way of protecting their species or whatever it is? But I want this group of people go to the alien planet and find out. I thought that would be interesting. And then my other concept was that aliens come on Earth. And I said the poster is, you know, cornfield in middle America. At night, you see a little farmhouse on the side of the field. And then in the middle of the field, there are aliens going through the field. I said, that to me is a hit film. And studio said, no, aliens can't come on Earth. And no, we don't want to go to that. And so their concept was they wanted to do a prison spaceship and the aliens go on a prison spaceship. And I said, I think it's so wrong. It's like, who is going to care about prisoners? Let the aliens eat them. They're criminals. They're murderers. Rapists. I don't care about them. I can't relate to them. And the whole point is that you have to relate to these characters and feel for them. And they said, well, that's what we want to do. And we kind of went back and forth for several months, me like trying to change their mind, and they didn't. And they made Alien 3 on a prison ship, and it ruined the whole franchise. And it's no secret that I know David Fincher, and he's an amazing, great filmmaker, a genius. But it almost ruined his career because it was his first feature. He had only done musicals and music videos.
Yeah.
He took on Alien 3. It was a disaster. It ruined the franchise. The franchise died for years. And
your instincts were correct. And I think he just wasn't in a position. You were sort of in a little further down the road. Yeah. Right? You were in a position to say, you know, I can take a chance here. And he wasn't. And it seems in everything he says that he sort of regrets it, you know.
Yeah, and then then his lucky break was then that there was a little, you know, thriller at New Line called Seven, and they liked his visual style. So despite the failure of Alien 3, they said, "Well, what do we have to lose? It's a pretty cheap movie. It's a little movie. At least he'll make it look good." And his genius that made that movie a classic.
Going back to you, you went from Die Hard 2, which was another huge sequel success. And then, like, I know I want to get to Misfits in a second, but like, there's like a trio almost of Cliffhanger, Cutthroat Island, Long Kiss Goodnight that are all great and they're all original. And original kind of action, like, you went away from the sequel. Like, you had done a bunch of sequels, but those were all new. And I know you had to put a lot on the line, particularly Cutthroat Island. But it seems like at that point you had become accustomed to that. Like, that's kind of where you started, right? Like, I'm going to bet big on myself here.
Yeah, yeah. And it certainly, you know, wasn't always easy. And some things worked out better than others. But you just have to go into it with your heart and your passion and believe in it 1,000%. And then movie gods will ultimately decide, and more than anything, the audience will decide what they wanna watch. But
what I think is also amazing about those three movies is that whatever their receptions were at the time, and they varied of the three of them, but they're all kind of considered landmark, like they're considered important movies to the genre at this point. Like everybody looks back at them and sees them as like, oh, you got to see, like Long Kiss Goodnight is a great action movie. And Cliffhanger is a loved action movie. And I feel like you mentioned how you were shooting recently and you said something like, I love that I get to do this. I feel like all those movies, they convey that there's a real joy in what you get to do, like in the way that you approach it. Is that how you, when you're picking a project or developing something, do you look at it like, I want to have fun? I want this to be a fun movie?
Yeah, definitely. And whether it's comedic or it's a thriller or whatever the genre is, that's exactly what I think. It's and you know, making a thriller, it's kind of more serious than when you're making a comedy. You get to laugh, but the fun is the right word. It is so much fun, whether it's an emotional scene or dramatic scene or scary scene or funny scene. It's just so much fun to put together, and going to the set and having all those great people around you, the crew and the cast, and everybody's there just to make this vision become reality. It is the highest honor and pleasure and funnest thing in the world.
Yeah, and that's all I could think when I was watching Misfits was I was like, this is, they're having so much fun doing this. It reminded me to go back to, you know, the 90s era. It reminded me a little bit of The Rock. Kind of felt like a continuation of a Bond with a Bond star.
Yeah.
And it had this just fun, like, we're going to go all around the world. It's got heist, it's got action. But I guess my question is, the technology has changed a lot since you started. So when you're shooting a movie like Misfits, how do you make your decisions as a director with so much more that you can do through CG? I mean, when you started, there weren't the same possibilities. Nothing was digital. There was not the same VFX stuff. It was practical. Like, how does it change your approach?
Yeah, it's in a way, it's of course a benefit that sky's the limit now. But at the same time, I feel like we've lost something with the certain loss of reality. In earlier times, you know, it was the actors that have to do the stuff and then stuntmen doing the dangerous things. Mm-hmm. Now you have digidoubles and things like that, like an entire car chase might be digitally created. The audience doesn't even realize it. And you know, people are flying around and smashing things, and they are all digital. It's a cartoon. So of course it gives you more opportunities, but it also, to me, it's taken something away. And I think the audience to a certain extent can tell the difference. And I think they appreciate it when they feel like it's real sweat and tears that went into making something. And I certainly like doing that. And that way, in the case of the Misfits, for example, there's hardly anything digital in it. It's pretty much all done for real.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's cool. I would agree. You can't always tell, but I think subconsciously you can tell when you're looking at basically a cartoon. Yeah. How do you, when you go into it, like how do you make sure that you keep it grounded? You just decide, I'm going to do a certain amount of this practical?
Yeah. Yeah. I try to do everything practical. And then if it's ridiculous because of cost reasons or something like that, then you try to use the tools in a smart way. And of course, there's a certain joy to that too. But definitely, I try to keep it grounded. There's a lesson I learned. For example, when I was doing Cliffhanger, there was one scene that where Stallone, to put it bluntly, he pretty much jumps from one mountain face to another, and it was a pretty spectacular stunt. And I thought it was going to be one of the key stunts in the movie and an amazing thing. When we test screened the movie, the audience was loving the movie. They were applauding and they were hooting and hollering and enjoying the movie until that scene happened. And all of a sudden, you just could feel the air let out of the room. And like, we could totally feel it. And we were just mystified that what the hell is this? And then when we talked to the focus group after that, and looked at the cards that people had filled, it was crystal clear. We had succeeded so well in the movie with audience believing that Sylvester Stallone is on this mountain and this character is doing these things and he's human. And then when he did this thing, which I thought, oh, what a great stunt, the audience felt completely cheated and they felt like they had invested in this character and now that trust that we had built between the audience and the character had been broken. And now all bets were off. Okay, well, that character is not really real. He can do anything. He can jump from one mountain to another.
Wow.
So why doesn't he start flying? So I learned the lesson is that you have to establish the ground rules with the audience, and then you have to stick to them. And if you cheat, you will lose the audience.
That's amazing. And you learned it by listening to the reactions from audiences and test screenings.
Yeah. And then we cut that whole expensive big stunt. We cut it out of the movie and we had to construct another way how he gets from one mountain to another.
Wow.
And we found a way to do
it. So he was basically became too powerful, essentially.
Yeah.
Like they bought his humanity and his vulnerability until that moment.
Yeah.
That's something I think that with all these, like you were saying, all the cartoons, the CG, like I think the stakes vanish sometimes because you're like, well, this guy, this isn't a real person and they're
exactly.
in a super suit. They can do whatever they want.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's amazing. And so, and then going forward, you just kind of kept in mind, like I have to stick to the ground rules.
I've always kept that in mind that you can't betray the audience. The audience, you're building every shot, every scene, every character moment, you're building trust with the audience. And it's like a bank account and you're depositing with every scene, you're depositing in that bank account and you can't rob that account by robbing the trust.
That's great. That's just great advice. I actually usually wrap up by asking people if they have advice to filmmakers starting out, but that advice I like so much.
There
I don't
want
to ask because it's so true. People are so quick to violate that. And I also think the other side to that lesson is that even if it was a most expensive thing and you loved it when you did it, you might have to just cut it, right?
Yep.
Totally. How often does that happen? I mean, is that like you find yourself like, oh man, that was so great, but we just got to cut it.
It happens. I call it killing your darlings. And I've learned, you know, in the beginning of my career, I was a typical director who was in love with my shots and complicated shots that I had created. And no matter what, I would want to keep some shot just because so much work went into it. And it's such a fancy shot. And I thought my filmmaker colleagues will look at it and say like, wow, what a shot. But I'm nowadays like no shot for me is worth having just because it's beautiful. It's if it doesn't tell the story, if it doesn't advance the story and support the characters, then it's gonna go. So you learn to be healthy about that kind of stuff.
Don't rob the bank. I love it.
Yeah.
That's basically never rob the bank. Well, we have to wrap up, but thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank
I'm excited
you,
about the movie, and it was great to have you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much to Rang Harlan for being on the podcast. It was really fun to talk to him. I really enjoyed his insights into things, particularly his wherewithal when things weren't looking good, his desire to prove the doubters wrong, but also his lesson, establishing ground rules. Don't rob the bank. These are great things for anybody at any level. Thanks again. Check out The Misfits. It's in theaters now. Be sure to like, rate, and subscribe to this podcast. Send us questions for our weekly show, which drops every Thursday morning. And let us know what you think of our guests. Our guest interviews drop every Tuesday. We are very excited about Black Magic Week, which is coming up at the end of this month. So be sure to check it out on the website, in the podcast, on YouTube. All kinds of places.